Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is returning guest, Ronnie Störfele. He's the managing partner at Incrementum. He's a fund manager and also the author of the annual In Gold We Trust report. How are you today, Ronnie?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me again. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Recently, on May 27th, you guys released the 2020 In Gold We Trust report. And why don't you give us a couple of the highlights from this year's report?
As you know, we tend to write pretty longish reports. So this year's extended version is roughly 360 pages. And the leitmotif of this year's report is the dawning of a golden decade. So we really don't care about the very short-term noise. And we really want to make the case for gold over the long term. So we analyze the most important developments in the decade ahead. We, for example, say that the world is actually running out of safe havens and that gold might take the role of government bonds going forward. We talk about inflation dynamics, which is probably one of the most important drivers and the biggest question going forward. We talk about the gold demand, Western world versus the Eastern world, especially Asia. Then we analyze long-term topics like de-dollarization. We've got a fantastic interview with Luke Roman. But we also talk about things like more structural and theoretical things like capital consumption, which we call the pathway to poverty. We talk about Bitcoin and similarities and differences between gold and Bitcoin and how they might fit together in a portfolio. And this year, we've got a special chapter on silver, because silver, from our point of view, is one of the most interesting investments out there. And of course, we also talk about the developments in the mining space, which also looks really, really attractive, both from a technical and from a fundamental point of view. So yeah, it's some heavy reading. You have to take off probably a couple of hours at least, or even a weekend. But I think it's really worth the time. And we also try to make it, you know, worthwhile, thought-provoking, but also fun and entertaining to read.
Well, going through it to do some research, there's definitely some entertainment in there. There's some funny quotes, some good comics and stuff. But there's also an absolute, basically, treasure trove of information there. The full report is over 300 pages. The compact version is just under 100. And there's also a chart book highlighting all the charts that you have in there, the ingoldwetrust.report website. So why don't we get into one of the really interesting points that I found there about how the coronavirus wasn't necessarily a black swan, as everybody was saying, but more of a gray rhino.
Yeah, well, I kind of developed this analogy for a previous keynote speech that I gave at the World Gold Forum. And I said, actually, Many analysts and intellectuals like Nassim Taleb, for example, they made the case that such a pandemic is only a question of time, and therefore there are a few governments who already had the plans laid out, and they exactly knew what to do. And for us, the pandemic was only the catalyst for the crisis and for the recession. If you remember our 2019 report, back then we said, okay, we've got a yield curve inversion, which is probably the most reliable indicator for a weakening economy. The US is in an earnings recession. Germany, one of the biggest and most important export nations, was very, very close to a technical recession. Numbers coming out of Germany, but also coming out of South Korea, were weakening dramatically. Then we saw that the Federal Reserve had to make a big U-turn. So they started, you know, they're not QE4 again. We saw that, that they lowered interest rates again. And I think that's one of the most convincing economic numbers. Actually, trade volume last year declined by 0.5%, and we only saw that in 2009 and in 1981, both years of recession. So for me, the recession call was pretty easy, and we always said gold is one of the very few reliable recession hedges. Of course, I would be a liar if I would have said, okay, a virus coming out of some Chinese markets where people thought they have to eat bats or whatever, that would be the trigger for the recession. But I think, you know, it is, we compare it to the so-called Anna Karenina principle. You know that the great novel by Leo Tolstoy. He said all happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And it's very similar with recessions. So actually, upswings are usually quite similar, but every economic downturn has its own characteristics and its own triggers. But the way leading up to the bust is always basically influenced and fueled by extremely expansive monetary inflation. We've had that in the 90s. We've had that leading up to the subprime crisis. We had that in the roaring 20s leading to the Great Depression. And we had that over the last couple of years. So therefore, we said, okay, recession is around the corner. Now the big question, of course, is if it's going to be just a really dramatic recession, and it's probably going to be the first worldwide recession in the last, I think, 60 or 70 years, or if it's going to be a depression. So that's really the big question. I cannot answer it for now, but I think, you know, what's really counts is the steps that were taken not only by central bankers, but also by fiscal policy. And those steps, they are really, really historic. They are unprecedented. And this should be a very, very positive driver for gold going forward.
So as we look at one of the biggest characteristics going into a crash like this is the trust in the central banks eroding. Can you tell us a little bit about why that erosion is happening, the erosion in trust, and when we're really going to start to see the kind of more of a mainstream distrust in the central banks and what their policies are going to do to the currency?
Yeah, well, last year we said the leitmotif of last year's report was the erosion in trust. And we said, you know, we're seeing this loss of trust in many aspects of our lives. We're seeing it in the media. We're seeing it in politics, where, you know, the gap between right and left is getting bigger and bigger, and it's everything is more polarized. We're seeing it, of course, when it comes to the economy, some sort of a, you know, two-speed economy. But we also said that for some reason, trust in central bankers is still pretty high. And we said at some point, this trust might be eroding. Now, trust is something extremely asymmetrical. Remember Lehman Brothers, for example. They didn't make a quarter losses, I think, for more than 100 years. But then just a couple of weeks when the market lost faith in the balance sheet, in the liquidity of Lehman Brothers, and the market lost trust in Lehman Brothers being a reliable counterparty, and it was over. It is the same if you're married like for 30 years and you build up trust capital, and then you come back earlier and you see your wife, you know, in bed with your neighbor or the postman, whatever, then the trust is lost. Now, when it comes to central bankers, I mean, we shouldn't forget that they are, you know, the words that they put in the last couple of weeks, this is really like a monetary all-in. You know, Jay Powell on 60 Minutes, he said, well, there's a lot more we can do. We've done what we can as we go, but I will say that we're not out of ammunition by a long shot. No, there's really no limit to what we can do with these lending programs that we have. Then there was Stephen Pollos, the governor of the Bank of Canada. He said, a firefighter has never been criticized for using too much water. So it means And I think this is the big difference compared to 2008 and 2009. They will act much more aggressively, and they already acted much more aggressively than in 2008. And this also means that the consequences will come earlier, and this loss of trust is probably closer. Now, from my point of view, it is not only unlimited monetary expansion, it is also basically unlimited use of fiscal expansion. Just until end of April, 22 trillion, I think that's roughly 20% of world GDP, have been implemented by monetary and fiscal stimulus. So that's a pretty big number. And for me, that just means that those measures will push up all assets that are basically non-quantitatively easable. Things like gold, things like Bitcoin, things like mining stocks, perhaps also real estate and equities. Then at some point, we really might reach this so-called crack-up boom that Ludwig von Mises described brilliantly. So this is the point when the market participants lose faith in paper money, in paper currency, and they just want to buy hard assets. And you know, having a look at stock prices now, having a look at real estate prices, having a look at gold, of course, it seems that we're in the first stage of that crack-up boom.
So as we're seeing this giant balance sheet expansion, normal indicators for central banks are kind of looking in the rearview mirror for inflation or deflation. Incrementum has a way of looking in a way forward through the windshield instead of back through the rearview mirror. What are you guys seeing for inflation or deflation, maybe even stagflation expectations going forward from here?
Yes, we said we're managing one fund that invests in inflation sensitive assets. So in mining stocks, which are extremely sensitive to changes in inflation, we're investing in precious metals, of course. We're investing in commodity currencies like the Russian ruble, the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar. We're investing in silver and in base metals, of course. So for us, inflation dynamics are really crucial for our asset allocation. Now, as you've said, all those statistics published by bureaucrats like CPI or PCE, first of all, they're looking into the rearview mirror, and then they're highly subjective. And you know, we could discuss the way that they're calculated. So, Tom, we've got a couple of alternative inflation indicators in our report. For example, the beer to gold ratio that tells us that, for example, inflation at the Oktoberfest is at 5% on average. And I think it is really something that people just feel that their inflation is significantly higher than those numbers coming out of government statistics. Now, when it comes to our inflation indicator, we said, okay, we really want to gauge what is the market telling us? Where does the market see inflation dynamics? We use a couple of indicators and then create one overall signal. And this, for example, includes the gold-silver ratio. Let's not forget in March, when basically the panic was really extreme, the gold-silver ratio hit basically an all-time high at 125. So you could buy 125 ounces of silver with 1 ounce of gold. And the gold-silver ratio is a very reliable inflation-deflation indicator. So this is one part of the model. Then we use, of course, the price of gold itself. From our point of view, if we're seeing massive disinflation, then gold prices will have a very hard time. Then we use, for example, ratios like mining stocks versus the S&P. We use commodity prices because, you know, let's face it, I wouldn't expect inflation to become a big topic when oil is trading at 20 bucks or when base metals are trading at low levels. And then we basically combine those indicators to one signal. And this is really, for us, it's important to catch the big move. So the inflation signal worked extremely well in real time, and we're managing one of our funds based on that model. And it told us to broadly get out of inflation-sensitive assets already in February. And now we have got the full inflation signal again. So actually, we started investing in inflation-sensitive assets already a couple of weeks ago. And it is not only the signal, it is also, of course, the fundamental picture that is telling us that inflation might be around the corner. So we shouldn't forget that the debt will get monetized years down the road. So when the velocity of money picks up, from our point of view, inflation is coming back. It will be the biggest comeback since, I don't know, Rocky IV, if you remember that tremendous movie. But we shouldn't forget that velocity is also a psychological factor, and it is intertwined with trust. So as I've said, trust is asymmetrical. So once people regain trust in the economy again, velocity will pick up, and all the money that was created over the last couple of months, this would have to be basically taken out of the market by central banks. I don't think that's going to happen. And then there are several structural things that suggest that actually inflation will become a concern. We should not forget that productivity is suffering at the moment. It is suffering big time. We should not forget that topics like deglobalization will be acting as an inflationary tailwind. And then I think that a weak US dollar, And my friend Brent Johnson is making a very strong case for a blowout of the US dollar. So extremely strong US dollar. But from my point of view, it is really Donald Trump versus financial markets. And we know it's an election year. We know that basically everybody wants and needs a weak US dollar. So from my point of view, we will see over the next couple of quarters a very, very weak US dollar, and this might act as a huge inflationary tailwind. So inflation-sensitive assets are already telling us, okay, inflation might be around the corner, but it is still probably one of the biggest contrarian calls that you can make. Let's not forget that at the moment there are 14 trillion in bonds trading at negative yields. Now, when inflation becomes a concern, of course there will be money coming out of those 14 trillion negative yielding bonds, and it will flow into real estate markets, it will go to equity markets, but of course it will also go into the gold market, which is, as you know, the most reliable inflation hedge over the last couple of centuries. So inflation for us, it is not only a tail risk, it is basically one of our basic scenarios over the next couple of years.
So as we think about gold as an inflation hedge, one of the really interesting charts that I came across in the report was the three phases of public participation in the gold market. Can you explain to us what the three phases are and where we are in those?
Yes. So, you know, Tom, I started as an analyst in an Austrian bank at Erste Bank. And in 2007, I started writing about gold, and I really didn't have a clue about gold and about sound money. And my boss told me that I should get a CFA. And you know, I said, you know, that's too boring for me. I'm not that kind of guy learning for the CFA. It's just not something that really interests me. So I said, let's do the CMT, which is the Chartered Market Technician. And it taught me really a lot about market dynamics. And for me, technical analysis is just, you know, it's another tool in my toolbox. So I really try to use the combination of my fundamental macro views and then implement them based on my technical views. So one of the foundations of technical analysis is the so-called Dow theory. So Charles Dow, he was the founder of the Wall Street Journal, and he calculated, of course, the Dow Jones Industrials Index. And Charles Dow, he said that every trend, every big trend, has got basically three phases. The first phase is the so-called accumulation phase. So that's the first phase where the most informed, the astute and contrarian investors buy. So the media sentiment is extremely negative. And if you go to a cocktail party and say, you know, I'm buying gold or I'm buying mining stocks now, they will either throw you out or just ridicule you. From my point of view, we saw this phase from 2013 until June 2019. Last year, we said as soon as we go above this massive resistance zone, 1360 to 1380, and this basically happened just 1 year ago, then we will go into the second stage of this Dow theory model. And this is the so-called participation phase. This is when prices start to rise slowly, when trend followers are showing interest, when the news are improving, when commentators, the media, and so on become increasingly optimistic, when volumes and interest are rising and new products are being launched. And we really can see that. So if you have a look at analyst consensus, you can see, you know, most of the Wall Street analysts are getting more positive about gold. They don't have any crazy price targets out yet, except Bank of America, I think, with a $3,000 price target. And I can also tell that the media is calling me again. So we're just seeing, you know, that the party is getting going. But the second stage, this public participation phase where we are in now, this is the longest phase. Yeah. And then the third stage is, of course, the distribution phase. So that's the mania phase where everybody is getting crazy and you've got this time it's different, euphoria. So this is also the time when you should actually, you know, leave the party. And I think we are far away from that. But at the end of this cycle, like in every big bull market, we will see this distribution phase where gold will go crazy over a couple of weeks. But at the moment, this is still a very, very solid and a very healthy bull market that we're in.
Excellent, Ronnie. Earlier, you had mentioned the silver versus gold ratio. So as we've seen that top, like that all-time high in the silver versus gold ratio, explain to us why silver might be even more of a contrarian investment right now than gold.
So our models basically tell us that it's always gold that is moving first, then silver is following, and then it's the broad commodity complex. And, you know, commodities itself are even more contrarian than silver at the moment. And people ask us, why are you bullish on commodities like copper? And we say, you know, it is fiscal stimulus that will be implemented, because every politician all over the globe that wants to win elections, he's going to say, okay, we have to implement big infrastructure programs. We have to get the economy and the building industry going again. And of course, this will very, very positively impact commodity markets and especially base metals. But silver is really coming right after gold. And from our point of view, it is also some sort of a sentiment indicator on gold. Now, normally within the course of a gold bull market, silver always outperforms. And I think that we just saw the beginning of this move. We saw a really huge reversal of the gold-silver ratio. And in our report, we really show some very, very long-term charts about the gold-silver ratio. And actually, this ratio really hit an all-time high in March last year. So from our point of view, it is something that it is basically underestimated from financial market participants that now it seems that you know, central bank independence is more and more questioned. So we have seen some actions, for example, in the UK, where basically the Bank of England directly buys debt issued by the government. We have seen some very interesting comments coming out of India, but also New Zealand, where the central bank governor, Adrian Orr, he said he's open-minded about buying the nations directly from the state. as the central bank mulls over policy responses to tackle the coronavirus crisis. Direct monetization, he said, has been a heresy taboo for a long time, but it's only a long time in our lifetime. And therefore, I think that direct debt monetization and the more closer cooperation between monetary and fiscal stimulus and monetary and fiscal policy, this will really be one of the biggest drivers going forward. Now, why is it important for silver? Because traditional quantitative easing worked over the banking sector. So central bankers wanted to create credit growth by stimulating the banking sector, while the measures that are about to be taken will have a much more direct effect. Let's face it, topics like MMT, like QE for the people, like universal basic income. A couple of quarters ago, that was basically the wet dream of some weirdo economists. Nowadays, this is really going mainstream. And I think, you know, with elections coming up, we can be rest assured that those policy will be implemented. And to some degree, they have already been implemented. Just have a look at all those stimulus measures that were created over the last couple of weeks. And those have got a much more direct impact on consumption, on the economy, but also on inflation. And from my point of view, this will be one of the most important drivers, one of the most important macro drivers for silver. But then we should not forget that when it comes to silver, I think that there's actually, and we analyzed that in detail, that 6 out of the 8 sources of supply are actually stagnating. And we should not forget that at some point, investors' demand will pick up significantly, because at some point people will say, okay, we've got gold mining stocks, but we need a bit more, you know, a bit more oomph, a bit more volatility, a bit more beta. So they will go into the silver market. And from my point of view, I would really be surprised if the decade or the 2 decades ahead will not be some of the best years in silver's really long history.
Something with a far shorter history than silver and gold is Bitcoin. And you were speaking earlier about there's a part in the report that we're seeing that we need to possibly pay attention to Bitcoin. So could you contrast Bitcoin and gold for us, please?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there are lots of similarities. And Paul Tudor Jones just said, Bitcoin reminds me of gold when I first got into the business in 1976. So from my point of view, you know, especially now after the halving, Bitcoin has basically the same stability, the same stock to flow ratio like gold. And it is a non-inflatable asset. And this is also the reason why we just really successfully launched a fund that combines physical gold and Bitcoin, and where we use the enormous volatility of Bitcoin for an option strategy. We call it vol harvesting. So I think from my point of view, Bitcoin will really go mainstream over the next couple of years. It will be normal for institutional investors to have even a minor allocation in digital assets. And I just think that the whole macro developments that we have seen over the last couple of weeks, you know, all this debt creation, and let's face it, the higher indebted you are as a household, as a company, or as a government, the higher the wish and the higher the need for inflation and the higher the fear of deflation. So the system will do everything they can to create inflation. And therefore, I think it's all about relative supply curves. And those relative supply curves for gold and for Bitcoin are pretty similar. So, you know, from my point of view, Bitcoin should also be, it's high risk, but also high reward. And I think it also should be in every portfolio. And we've got, you know, we are analyzing this so-called Plan B model. This is based on the stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin. And we explain the similarities, but also the differences between gold and Bitcoin. And we have always been pretty positive cryptos. We started writing about Bitcoin already in 2013 in our In Gold We Trust report, because we thought Satoshi Nakamoto, who basically put out this white paper as a reaction to the great financial crisis 2008-2009, we thought that Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever it was, he understood the flaws of our monetary system, and he wanted to create an answer or an insurance against those flaws and those risks. And therefore, I think that he perfectly understood sound money and that he understood gold.
Excellent, Ronnie. One of the other questions I wanted to ask you, you know, considering how much information goes into this report, you have a lot of resources that really inform your decision making. So can you share some of the, let's say, best books that you reread from time to time with us, and maybe some sources of news as well that you really find valuable?
Well, I tweeted out today, and this is really a coincidence, I said that I'm a big fan of rereading books, because, you know, the more often you read it, the more you understand it, and the more you appreciate the words. It is like, you know, hearing a good music album. You just don't say, okay, I'll hear it once, like, I don't know, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or a Beatles album or whatever. You just don't hear it once and then that's it. And then you go to the next one, but you keep rehearing it, because then every time you hear it again, you just enjoy and understand the small things, the nuances much more. And this is why I'm a big fan of rereading books. But I'm also a person who, you know, after the first couple of chapters, if I don't like it, I just, you know, skip the book and don't end reading it. So I said a couple of books that I keep rereading every couple of years. Those are The World of Yesterday by Stefan Zweig, which perfectly describes the inflation, the hyperinflation in Germany and in Austria. Love, Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb. I liked it much more than The Black Swan, for example. But also some novels like, you know, Kafka on the Shore, for example, by Murakami, one of my favorite books. Then what else? The Raven of Zurich by Felix Omari, a brilliant book. And from the Austrian economists, I really like Liberalism by Ludwig von Mises. So those are a couple of books that I just enjoy reading again now and then. And when it comes to information, I think it's highly subjective. I mean, I've got a couple of newsletters that I read every day. I think Dave Rosenberg is fantastic. I really read him every day. I love The Macro Tourist. Then, of course, there's some more specific analysis for mining stocks, for inflation, and more macro topics. And that's basically it. But I actually really try to not consume too much information coming from the, you know, traditional news, because it's just basically worthless what you're reading in a newspaper, because everybody knows it anyway, so it's already priced in. And one platform that I use really highly to communicate, first of all, with friends and colleagues from all over the globe, but also, you know, to ask questions and get a feeling for markets, is of course Twitter, where I'm very, very active.
Excellent, Ronnie. We'll have all those resources in the show notes as well for everyone that would like to find them a little bit better. Ronnie, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
No, basically not. I think, you know, it's this year has already been quite a roller coaster, quite challenging, but actually I enjoyed the challenge. And I think, you know, those things that are happening now, we will probably tell our grandkids about it. There is lots of threats, but also lots of opportunities out there. And, you know, we try to analyze and explain those opportunities in our In Gold We Trust report. We got tremendous feedback really from all over the world. And And therefore, we are already working on the 2021 edition. But now, for the next couple of days, I hope it's going to be a bit calmer, and I'll have some time to relax, because publishing 360 pages in German and in English, that's a hell lot of work. We really try to be as perfectionist as possible. There are roughly 400 footnotes in the report, lots of references to other sources and studies. So I really hope that you and your listeners will enjoy reading it. We gave our best. We invested roughly 20,000 hours of research and work into this report, and therefore it's a really, it makes me really glad and happy that we're getting so much positive feedback really from all over the world, and that's what makes us keep going.
Well, I know I've really enjoyed going through it, and I find it very valuable. Just before we go, why don't you share with us a price target for gold?
Well, we set our price target based on our proprietary, which is taking into account, first of all, monetary growth rates and basically the gold backing of the US dollar. We came up with a price target at $4,800 for the end of this decade. Now, that sounds extremely optimistic, but actually, this is like a compound annual growth rate of 10.9%. So if you calculated that like that, it's not that bad. If we would have growth rates like in the 1970s, a highly inflationary or stagflationary environment, we would come up with a price target at $8,900. But you know, all those models, I know they are just theoretical, of course, and they include a certain degree of fuzziness. So don't blame me if we only reach 4,700 in 2030. But it is just, you know, we really tried the best to explain the thought process behind this model as good as possible. And I think it makes sense, because we regard gold as a monetary asset and not as a commodity. And therefore, you have to analyze it like a currency.
Perfect, Ronnie. That's definitely something to look forward to for all of us. Thanks for your time today, Ronnie.
Thank you very much, Tom. All the best to you. And yeah, looking forward to talking to you very soon again. Take care. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?